If we privatize the energy industry in Venezuela, which will be privatized gradually, and we allow private operators to come in and say, hey, look, Venezuela's no longer this single state-owned electricity like utility company that has to finance all of the power generation projects nationwide with the help of XYZ Bitcoin mining company. If we work together, we do a JV, you know, they can help us basically monetize that excess supply, energy supply, that we would have previously been unable to get demand for with only like a rural village in Venezuela. So again, it's like an added benefit and another potential way of working out things for the benefit of Venezuela and the benefit of the electrical grid, the benefit of the energy sector, and it adds up another way.
Hey everybody, Frank here. Just wanted to say thanks to everyone who's tuned in to the previous two episodes. The reboot of the show is definitely gaining some traction, and we greatly appreciate your support and attention. On that note, before we get started with this episode, if you could hit the like and subscribe buttons, that would be fantastic. If you could leave a comment, that'd be even better, or maybe even a review if you're listening on a podcast app. Also, as for the conversation that you're about to listen to, I'm super pumped to share it with you all, as I believe Bitcoin mining will play a major role in the revitalization of Venezuela, including the rehabilitation and reconstruction of the country's power grid. Yes, I think it's going to play that big of a role in the country. So just to get you guys a little bit pumped up for what you're about to hear. Finally, if there are any guests you'd like to see on New Renaissance Capital, please email me at newrencap@gmail.com. That's newrencap@gmail.com. And with that said, let us get to the episode. Here is my conversation with Alessandro Cesare, El Sultan de Bitcoin on X. Welcome back, everybody. We are here with the third episode of the reboot of New Renaissance Capital. I am Frank Corva, joined by a very special guest today, El Sultan de Bitcoin, someone I followed on Twitter, X, forever, a Venezuelan, someone who was mining Bitcoin in Venezuela as far back as 2013, and eventually had to leave the country like most Venezuelans, or about a third of the population. We're going to talk a little bit about that. We're going to touch on what has, obviously, what has happened with Maduro no longer being in power, what Venezuelans actually think about that. And then I think the meat of the conversation will be around mining Bitcoin in Venezuela, something that I think Sultan wants to go back to do, along with Luxor, the company he now works for, just to get mining operations back up and running, which I think will be a little bit it's a little bit easier said than done, but we'll get into some of those intricacies in just a second. Let me pass the mic over to you, if you wouldn't mind, just a brief introduction for the audience.
First of all, thank you, Frank. It's finally a good connector. We're, you know, a couple of pings over X. I'm El Sultan, Venezuelan born. I've been a Bitcoin, as Frank mentioned, for about, you know, a little over a decade now. I got to see firsthand how Bitcoin was adopted in the country through different phases. So I'm sure we'll touch a little bit about that. And I'm excited to share a little bit more detail on the opportunity to mine Bitcoin with flared gas or other energy sources in the country as well. So,
okay. If you could, let's just start a little bit of background. So 2013, towards the end of 2013, you start mining Bitcoin. If you could break down, I'm personally curious, but I think the audience is probably also curious. What were things like in Venezuela at that time? What city were you living in? And I say this, I was living in Venezuela through 2011, but I know things got progressively worse moving into 2013, 14, 15. So what was the state of things? What eventually led you to start mining Bitcoin, something that you said was basically a financial lifeline for you and your family at the time?
Yeah, so 2013, 2014 was basically that period of time in Venezuela where Maduro was starting to do his campaign so he could become president. In 2014, he became president. When we're speaking about 2014 Venezuela, we're still speaking about almost 100% subsidized electricity rates, retail electricity rates. So basically, that's what helped click Bitcoin mining in the country. We're also talking about the era when the ASICs were starting to come out. So we're speaking about the Antminer S1, the Antminer S3 potentially. So I first started as a home miner in the country. My dad was his business. He was an architect and he had a small business, so he had a ton of like custom built PCs with like GPUs, and I used a couple of those GPUs for GPU mining purposes, and that's what helped us like realize the potential of Bitcoin mining. So we eventually scaled that to all the way up to 200 ASIC miners at some point. So my dad and I co-founded one of the first Bitcoin mining farms in the country, potentially one of the first in Latin America as well. But back then, we're still stuck talking about a time when the Venezuelan state really wasn't aware or paying attention too much to Bitcoin mining activity in the country. You were still just like this weird dude just playing with magic internet money. What are you doing? You're wasting your family's money on over the internet, that type of stuff. But we did that until 2015. By 2015, we're talking about a period where inflation had always been rampant since I was born in the country, but it was like gradually catching up to all the way to eventually hyperinflation in 2017. So when you're talking about that period, you saw increasing interest in general from Venezuelans in Bitcoin mining, but for the purpose of getting a dollar-based revenue. So yeah, so you have capital controls in the country, inflation is going up, salaries are still like capped or regulated. So as let's say you're a college teacher, if you were mining Bitcoin, you were making more money than being a college teacher or sometimes a doctor in the country. So that's how I would describe those initial like stages of Bitcoin mining back then in the country.
Yeah, because I know that I think someone like Mauricio from Ledin, he often tells his story, but he didn't start mining until what, 2016, or right before the government cracked down on it, if I'm not mistaken, maybe a year or two before the government cracked down. You were a bit earlier than him, if I'm getting this right.
That is exactly right.
Okay.
Yeah, I cashed out of my Bitcoin mining operations in 2015, specifically because it was starting to be cut to go into the purview of the Venezuelan state.
Okay. When you cashed out, did you or your family leave at that point? Where did you go? I mean, you had some Bitcoin. Were you trading it for dollars to then be able to leave? And obviously, please feel free to not include any details you can't include here, but just kind of curious as to, so you have this capital, you have this magic internet money as you referred to it. What do you do with it at that point?
Yeah, I still stayed in the country because the state of things wasn't that dire, I would say, as to 2017 or maybe 2019 pre-COVID, when the electrical grid started failing and that type of stuff. So back then, it was more there was still this discussion going over what we call Bitcoin Twitter of self-custody. How do you properly custody your Bitcoins yourself, especially after the MT. Gox debacle back then, right? So hardware wallets were still like a nascent thing. So that mostly got me interested into custody solutions. And so I spun up a small Bitcoin custody startup in the country. And that's what I dedicated my time for before I left Venezuela and eventually 2020.
Interesting. Okay, so you were custodying Bitcoin for other people who had it, like a custodial service for Bitcoin.
Yeah, I was helping small fintechs and some banks in the country figure out how to like set up their own Bitcoin custody setup so that they could, for the banks and their small like informal remittance providers, they were already using Bitcoin for like cross-border payments. So they would buy Bitcoin with bolivars and then sell them is still in local Bitcoins for dollars or euros. And so the idea and the pitch was basically, hey, why don't you custody a part of your Bitcoins yourself and remove like a counterparty risk? So it was mostly it.
Okay, very, very cool. And there was a decent market for that because I feel like with Bitcoin in Venezuela, as you said, there doesn't seem to be like a ton of people who were into it before. Well, I don't know of anyone before you. As you said, you built one of the biggest farms in the country, if not in Latin America. Was there a learning curve with this, or did Venezuelans, because of capital controls and because of the remittance market developing, did they intuitively sort of understand the value in Bitcoin as a result?
It definitely helped. Still, when you're talking about a new thing like a multi-signature, and hey, here's these different vendors, etc. Here's how we source these vendors securely. There's a bit of a learning curve as well.
Let's fast forward. You leave Venezuela in 2020. It's 2025. I think it happened. I'm sorry, it happened last month, I think, with Maduro. Time moves quite quickly these days. 6 years later, Maduro's captured by the United States government for good reason. I think people have very mixed feelings about this. When I say people, everyone from Venezuelans to New Yorkers. I personally attended Maduro's arraignment in the Southern District of New York. Was really, really kind of blown away to see a protest outside when I arrived, which I wasn't expecting, with Venezuelans waving a Trump for King flag, chanting USA, while Americans are saying free Venezuela, release President Nicolas Maduro. My brain has not been the same since that moment. It was quite a moment in time. But I did post something on Instagram and said, you know, before you critique Venezuelans for being happy about the fact that Maduro was gone, not necessarily happy about how it happened, but just happy that he's gone, please understand the damage that this human being did to Venezuela, obviously as a predecessor, as someone who followed in Chavez's footsteps. Could you talk a little bit about, in your opinion, how the average Venezuelan feels about the current state of things in Venezuela?
Positive. And I think there's polls that, you know, somewhere over 70% approval of a U.S. intervention. So, look, different reasons as to why, obviously, but when Maduro took power, the Maduro administration, the debt, Venezuela's debt, was circling around $32 billion. Today, it stands at $180 billion. And the big issue is, you know, back then, that was like 30% GDP, but GDP contracted 70% as well during the Maduro administration. So right now, our debt is 180% of GDP.
That's a lot. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, look, the also, I think it is illegal under Venezuelan law for the central bank to finance the government's deficit, basically, to finance the government when they're in deficit, or the state oil company, PDVSA.
Yep.
Right now, the Venezuelan central bank is financing both. Like, PDVSA and the government are still being able to run it to a great extent because it is being finalized, but it is being financed, I'm sorry, by the Venezuelan Central Bank's money printer, basically. So it's new issuance of money. And this is what, for the most part, has, you know, created this hyperinflationary problem in the country.
The fact that they continue to finance things like this, essentially there's no real income or no industry in the country. They're just printing money to keep these industries going, essentially.
Exactly.
Okay. Interesting. So generally speaking, Venezuelans are happy Maduro's gone. I know that there are some people who have, you know, obviously mixed feelings or are against it. As you said, it's about maybe 70% of the population or so. It's not just going to be that a switch gets flicked right now. Actually, before we go there, Delcy Rodriguez, the former vice president under Maduro and now the acting president of the country, your personal thoughts on her? What does the average Venezuelan think about her as well?
She's closely tied to the previous administration. And you could argue that it's the same administration to a great extent. It's just being audited and fully controlled by the U.S. government at this point. So I think in general, we don't favor her being the president. Mm-hmm. I think in general, we see as illegitimate Maduro's presidency, all of them. But let's specifically talk about the last one, right, in the last elections, which, you know, the proof is there that the opposition leader, Edmundo González, really won that election. So without getting too much into the details, into the weeds of it, you know, she's de facto president right now, an interim president. And so de facto, the U.S. administration is recognizing Maduro as a president, if that makes sense.
Yep, I understand. And also with Edmundo González, I think people might be a little bit confused there because Machado is the person that people think should be president right now. Can you talk about how, I believe I would say the best way to put it, he served as a proxy for Machado, if I'm not mistaken. Is that the best way to put it? Could you describe that dynamic a bit?
That is the right way to describe it. She was ruled ineligible for the elections, and that's why she elected a proxy. So that's why, in theory, he should be the president of Venezuela right now. But also, it is what it is. Look, there is a reality in Venezuela, which is the military side of things. And it's a harsh truth, because the opposition has no connection with him. So in my personal, this is purely a personal view, but in my personal view, one angle by which the opposition has failed is they did a great job speaking to the civilian, but they did a very poor job speaking to the military.
I appreciate that perspective. I think it's really important. I tweeted about this as well. I tried to people who just thought it was going to be all roses and either Machado was going to come in or they're going to have an election tomorrow. I think what most people don't understand is that level of connection that was first established by Chavez and the military and then obviously furthered by Maduro and the military. It's he or she or they who controls the military or has that connection is essentially in control in the country. And if that doesn't just change tomorrow because Venezuelans or the United States even wants to see the next democratically elected Venezuelan president, we all want that, I think, as proponents of democracy and people who want to see a free Venezuela. But as you just mentioned, from my understanding and based on what you just said, the reality is far different. You basically have to have the military under your control, and Machado does not have that right now. And Delcy Rodriguez definitely does have that relationship right now. Does that change at any point, and what changes that?
That is a great question, and I believe that nobody knows. But I think the U.S. Energy Secretary Chris Wright, who recently visited Venezuela, he did provide signal that between 18 to 24 months, we're talking about democratic elections again in the country. Mm-hmm. So we're potentially speaking about a up to 2-year transition period. The same as this is the transition phase for Venezuela, etc. So, you know, we'll see how that goes. And I believe that under an audit, like if we do have democratic elections again and the U.S. is monitoring the elections, I couldn't foresee a future where the current Venezuelan administration remains in power and not a new one.
Understood. Okay. So it's not necessarily that Machado is coming into power. She might run in whatever that democratic election looks like at that point. It's just that ideally we see another election at some point. It's not that she just sort of takes the reins.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Interesting. There was a lot of talk. I've spoken personally with Leopoldo Lopez about this, and there's been a lot of talk about ways in which Bitcoin might be able to help in Venezuela. And for the sake of this conversation, I'm not going to dive into whether or not Venezuela has this huge Bitcoin fund that some have said that they have. I don't think that's the case. I think it was Jorge Girasati and Mauricio went over this on Laura Shin's podcast and, basically said it is probably not likely. But I think one of the things that I know Leopoldo is excited about on some level and other people in the Bitcoin space is the idea of mining Bitcoin again within the country and even potentially that being something that helps for the country to build capital reserves back up. Mining Bitcoin with stranded energy, with whatever renewable hydro, clean energy that exists in the country. But I think you, more than anyone, have done a great job in explaining to people that this is easier said than done right now. Part of the reason for that, the infrastructure in the country is shot, and it has been shot for a long time. It does not function properly. Much of the country right now doesn't have access to sustainable power. So from what I understand, please correct me on this statistic. I think you talked about the amount of demand in the country, which is around 13 gigawatts, and you wrote that there's only about 8 gigawatts of production for the time being. So setting up a backdrop here of what power production looks like, are you saying that almost half the country doesn't really have access to consistent power?
So 13 gigawatts is the top demand, the max demand on a yearly basis, which is basically when it gets hot and it's summer in the country, and people have to turn on their ACs, etc. So yes, currently what's mostly powering the electrical grid in Venezuela is the Guri Dam. Yep. The Guri Dam has a total installed generation capacity of a little north of 10 gigawatts. And it's currently producing only 8 gigawatts. So, we basically at some point during the year might go up to a deficit of 5 gigawatts in power. And that's why we get this like tactical shutdowns in the country. Some states lose electricity for a given period of hours. It's been up to some days in the past. So that's, however, we do have a total installed generation capacity of up to 30 to 36 gigawatts when you take into account our thermal production. But that needs some investment in CapEx because it's pretty much outdated, deprecated infrastructure. So it's not working properly. So this right here is where, you know, potentially Bitcoin mining could fall into the conversation because, you know, we basically could do what I said in that article, a cash for infrastructure swap. So big North American miners can come in. They can help us recapitalize the energy infrastructure, especially the ones that is gas powered. And here we're not talking specifically of only flared gas, which was part of the focus of the article. We're talking about any gas, right? Stranded gas. So if we allow them to come in, pour dollars into investing in infrastructure, and we give them guarantees so that we can sign long-term PPAs with them, so purchasing power agreements, and we give them the guarantee so that they can securely send their miners, set up operations, pay whatever taxes they have to pay, which that needs to be clarified, and we'll dive into that in a second. But basically, that's it. When we're talking about flare gas, now, there's potentially north of 2 gigawatts of flare gas that we're currently just like burning away, right? It's north of 13 billion cubic feet of gas. Okay, so it is a huge opportunity. Now, when I hear previously, like when I hear people from the state or with some connection to the Venezuelan state, whichever degree, Leopoldo or Maria Corina Machado, I understand that they might see the opportunity. However, what I think is we do have currently in Venezuela a legal framework that legalizes Bitcoin mining in the country. So you need to go to the crypto regulator, SunaCrypt. You need to notify your operations so you get approval through a Bitcoin mining license, basically. But there's no tax that is stipulated in that framework. So in theory, it's a zero cost. Just the legal cost of setting up a legal entity in the country, notifying to the regulator your activity, how big it's going to be, and eventually just maybe the tax for importing the miners, which is just like an import tax, right, on hardware equipment.
Yep.
Now, that's in theory. In practice, what's happening is you need to pay somebody that has affiliations with the government so that you can have basically protection so that nobody raids your operations. And you pay a bonus, whichever that might be, to get that license, which in theory should be somewhat free. So if you ask me, the way that the government would have to participate in this is just clarifying a tax. What is the royalty tax that miners or any operator in the country that's consuming energy and that's, you know, capturing this flare gas has to pay the state. Also, this is potentially a little bit more viable than just per se mining with the electrical grid because, Frank, inside this equation fall the American oil companies or even foreign oil companies. Because they're the ones that have the oil wellheads, right? They're the ones that are operating the oil fields. So they are specifically the ones that are flaring the gas.
Can I ask a question there? This is a great, a really, really important question. From my understanding, a lot of oil production in the country or gas production in the country stopped because as things broke down, as society essentially broke down in Venezuela, people literally stole even like the diamond heads off of the drills you would use to drill for it. This is what I was told years ago from family members, in the Venezuelan family members. And so Are there people extracting gas and oil? You're saying there are companies right now that are functioning there and that they're American companies? Were these deals made directly with the Maduro regime?
Chevron is in the country. Then you got Shell, Repsol, Eni, and I'm missing one. Yeah, but it's basically those four. So whichever those four or five companies, somebody gets to them first and pitches, hey, you're burning a ton of gas. We can buy that gas from you, okay? Or, you know, there's some business models in the industry already where the oil and gas company provides the gas at zero cost, but they get a part of the revenues, right? They do JVs, and so Green Flare Mining is doing this in Nigeria, for example, with a Japanese oil and gas company, okay? So it's doable. The models are there. It's just a matter of kicking off the discussion and providing North American miners or foreign mining companies, whatever, with the safety guarantees that they can, you know, ship hundreds of thousands of machines or thousands of machines, and that they won't be, you know, excessively tasked, or seized at customs, etc., or eventually at the oil fields. Now, that's one added benefit, in my view, of dealing with gas-flared mining in Venezuela, because you're basically, if you were able to do that, you're basically also somewhat backed by a foreign oil and gas company. So they already have, to a certain degree, guarantees, even better ones now, where they're operating, right? They're operating safely. Like, nobody comes in without, like, their approval or the state's approval. So you would be operating already in, like, let's call it a Bitcoin mining safe zone for the purpose of the conversation.
Okay. Because all parties would essentially be winning in this deal. So you'd be protected. Jurisdictional risk was always one of the biggest risks, obviously, in Venezuela, but particularly since they had a full crackdown in 2017. But I do want to back up just a little bit. You've referenced this article that you wrote. You posted it on X, so Bitcoin Mining Around the World, Venezuela. You did an incredible job in breaking down the nuances of what it would take to revive the Bitcoin mining industry or Bitcoin mining in general in Venezuela. Also, how Bitcoin mining could then rehabilitate and help restructure and repower the grid in Venezuela, which largely doesn't work. And there are certain parts of the country where it's difficult to get power from those parts of the country, which I think is the south through different parts of the country. So if you could you give us a bit of an overview, maybe for those who haven't seen or read this piece, of why you wrote the piece and then what was included in the piece?
Yeah, so first on that piece, I basically start with a bit of historical context. So diving into, at some point, you know, Venezuela, this is not mentioned in the article, but this is also a fact. At some point, Venezuela was the main supply of Bitcoin volume inside local Bitcoins in Latin America. Mm-hmm. So most of the activity in Latin America that was coming through local Bitcoins was specifically coming from Bitcoin mining in Venezuela. And, you know, they basically served as the supply side of Bitcoins in the continent, okay? So, you know, it's hard to track that data and historical data of, like, hash rate in Venezuela or per country back then. But there's some that would argue, including myself, that at some point Venezuela used to be a top 10 country by amount of hash rate managed globally, right? So
can I ask how much of the hash rate do you think was there maybe at the peak?
Yeah, I think that at some point we owned more than 5% of global hash rate on the country. Yes. Okay. So, you know, Venezuela was famously back then known as the Bitcoin mining cemetery as well. So most of the hardware that was becoming unprofitable, that was being squeezed through bear markets, you know, by American miners, they would send those machines to Venezuela. You know, to basically mine with less than a kilowatt, a cent per kilowatt hour.
Wow.
So, yeah, this very, very cheap rates, very hard to find elsewhere. Now, that was basically what I described in the article back then as the Wild West or the Far West era of Bitcoin mining in the country, because you're still speaking about not sophisticated miners or mining activities. You're still speaking about spreaded and decentralized Bitcoin mining activity. So this would be families that would buy, you know, all the way from one machine to 10 machines, whoever got interested in this, ramped it all the way up to 20 machines. But also, like, the hardware back then would last, like, what, like a year.
That's what I was going to say. You had to know how to repair these things if you were going to be sustainable, no?
Exactly.
Yeah.
2 years at most doing forward calculations for Bitcoin mining and like Bitcoin mining calculators, ROIs. That was insanely difficult. And also, look, the mining, the ASICs were, you know, you could plug them to a 120 volt infrastructure. Now we're talking about three phases. So these are 380 volt machines nowadays. It's purely, it became like an industrialized activity. So that's part of what I capture in the article. Now, based on what we're seeing at Luxor through hash rate index, Venezuela could have a little, like, six, I believe it's like 5x a hash of hash rate. So that basically positions us a little less than 0.5% of global hash rate currently. So we went from 5% global hash rate to 0.5% global hash rate. We lost potentially 90% of our participation in the global hash rate map or global hash rate wars, as some people would call it. Now, depending on how you look at it, most of the hardware that was shipped to Venezuela to mine Bitcoin was S7s and S9s. So we're talking about the 2017 window, etc. And that's basically now considered like obsolete mining equipment, not even old gen mining equipment. Okay, so if we measure it in terms of, you know, S9s, purely S9s mining in the country, we're speaking about potentially, you know, hundreds of thousands of miners currently operating in the country. Or okay, so like mining hardware. There's still some small miners that are currently mining with new gen and mid gen equipment, so like hydros, S21 hydros, etc. But there's very small activity. Okay, so at most we're like mining with very antiquated hardware. So if we upgrade that to, like, let's say American miners have right now sitting on some of their warehouses all generation mining hardware that is basically just squeeze or unprofitable in Texas right now or different parts of the US. If they ship that, they get to mine Bitcoin, you know, with all that hardware that they already own. And Venezuela would be in turn upgrading like our base Bitcoin mining fleet hardware. So we could potentially upgrade from S9s to S19s. If you do the same calculation of moving, you know, those, what is it in the article? I think we speak about 40 megawatts or something that we're using in the country. We could potentially go all the way up to 1.5% of global hash rate just by helping U.S. miners block the miners that they have sitting in their warehouses doing nothing, just by doing that. That's not even including the flare, the mining with flare gas. That doesn't include mining with the 20 plus gigawatts of installed capacity that we have with our thermal plants. So it could, you know, we could potentially become a top 10 or top 5 country by measured hash rate if we fully unlock all the potential of Venezuela for Bitcoin mining.
Amazing. It sounds quite exciting to hear all this. And I'm also, I just want to clarify, when you say American companies, you're talking about the major PubCos, Riot, Marathon. Is that what you're thinking when you say that, or private enterprises as well?
Enterprises as well. Yeah. Okay. You know, the likes of like Crusoe AI or like Crusoe Mining. They've already been mining with flare gas since 2018.
Okay.
So I think it's a mix. Okay. And probably at first, you know, before PopCo sends hundreds of thousands of miners, It'll probably be, a participant from the private sector, or sorry, like a private company, just saying, hey, let's ship 100 miners or 1,000 miners, see how it goes. I
Okay.
think that's how it'll unravel.
Do you think that there's sort of a potential? Do you think in the minds of some of these companies, there's maybe a first mover disadvantage in that? Because as we talked before, things are a bit uncertain with Dulce Rodriguez and her connections to the military, and we don't necessarily have assurances that these facilities that host this mining, that these things will be okay, that these machines will be okay. I mean, and sending over 100 machines, okay, granted, it's not all the machines in the world, but it's still, there's an expenditure there, right? What do you think it will take for these companies to feel comfortable moving in? It's going to be more than somebody's word, it seems like, because it just seems like the situation, while maybe it's better without Maduro, is still relatively uncertain and maybe even unstable. So what does it take to lay the sort of groundwork necessary to get started with this?
Good. That's a great question. And look, I think how I would start answering that, Frank, is for the listeners, you need to understand that everything related to the energy industry or energy sector in Venezuela is being fully audited by the U.S. Department of Energy. So there's no project that will be approved, nothing that will happen that will consume a considerable amount of energy in our grid or at a nationwide level without the US knowing it'll happen, without pre-approval from the US, basically. I think that US miners have done a great job, especially like Texan miners, at engaging with the energy regulator and the DOE and in the US. So the DOE is aware of, the potential of Bitcoin mining for curtailing purposes, for, capturing excess demand or excess supply of energy directly on site, right, where the electron is being generated. Venezuela needs most of our electrical problem right now, our energy demand problem, is more than a generation demand, it's a transmission demand. So we will need hundreds of millions of dollars, if not billions of dollars, to rebuild all those transmission lines, right? Recapitalize them, upgrade them. And potentially, a lot of that CapEx can be lowered if instead of building, per se, just transmission lines and potentially not capturing all of the power generation, right? All of the energy that we can generate from those sites, we could capture it with Bitcoin mining facilities right next to them. So I think that's something that will need to be pushed by the industry. So it is as an industry, us, that we will have to engage with the DOE and to some extent the utility company in Venezuela, Corpoelec, okay, which is fully state-owned but could potentially be privatized. And privatization is part of the talks and the requirements of the US and the Department of Energy with regard to the Venezuelan energy sector, okay, and Venezuela's energy industry participants in general. So I believe that the engagement of those talks to like push for a framework that can safely help foreign companies mine, legally and safely in the country, it will have to come from us, from the industry, from the
Okay.
Bitcoin miners ourselves, right? From the Bitcoiners. Now, why I emphasize on when I really say emphasize a lot, like, hey, US mining companies versus more general foreign companies, it's because if you look at our current agreement with the US, it's look, we're gonna buy you the oil. But you're going to use most of those proceeds to buy US goods and services. So if we go to the Department of Energy and we say, hey, look, there's all this flare gas, but you know what? We can sell it solely to US mining companies. And that's the deal. Look, this is a safe haven, but for US mining companies first, or at least the first right, right? And then maybe other companies can come in. But that's how I would expect things to unravel before, a big PUBCO sends miners to Venezuela, right? Like they will need to see some assurances, some framework that is being pushed, some new laws that are being passed. Maybe the current crypto regulator is unfit. It's been restructured more than 3 times in the country, and it's only resulted in corruption schemes. So maybe that doesn't work. Maybe we should, you know, shove it off. But who knows, Frank? Who knows?
You have this plethora of ideas, and I genuinely appreciate your enthusiasm, and I'm very grateful. I'm happy on behalf of, you know, I'm happy for the Venezuelan people that someone is thinking the way you're thinking, because I think the stakes here are incredibly high when it comes to enlivening the country, reinvigorating the power grid, making things work again for the Venezuelan people with this very misunderstood technology with Bitcoin, this technology that most people don't have a great understanding of. My question here for you is, you've been using we, and I think you're using that term as a Bitcoiner, but as someone who's going to be working with Luxor as well. So I'm curious as to what you imagine your personal level of involvement is going to look like. Do you plan to be back on the ground in Venezuela anytime soon? What are you going to be doing for Luxor? How much sway do you have over influencing some of these dynamics that you're talking about?
Yeah, I do plan on going back to the country, you know, sometime this year. I'm waiting for things to continue, like,
stabilizing.
Stabilizing. They are stabilizing. That's what we've seen from, you know, almost 2 months now since the intervention happened. But I will try to engage in talks locally to push for the idea with different parts of the current administration. I believe, as I mentioned, when we're speaking about the huge opportunity of mining Bitcoin with flared gas, I believe it's somewhat intelligent to try to engage the private side of the equation, which is the oil and gas companies, and like engaging with the executives that they have locally in Venezuela to pitch that idea. This is potentially something that will take years of talks. We are anticipating that. From a Luxor perspective, Luxor is a software and services Bitcoin mining company. We don't run operations ourselves, but we have a plethora of U.S. Bitcoin mining companies as clients of ourselves. And, you know, more broadly, globally, we have clients globally, you know, Middle East, Asia, Europe, Latin America, and the U.S. included as well, all of North America. So Luxor, one of the things that we serve is, you know, we have a pool. We have one of the biggest pools in the market. If we're gonna mine Bitcoin in Venezuela, those operations are gonna need a pool. Okay, why shouldn't we pick a U.S. pool versus a Chinese pool? Right. The conversations with the U.S. and the U.S. regulator are, how do we get out some of the Chinese and the Russians out of the country, and we give more participation to American companies? So that's one way we could help. Also, If we're speaking about mining in some part of Venezuela, we're talking potentially the rural side or the countryside of Venezuela. So those are places that during the summer gets hot. So miners will potentially want to underclock some of their operations and like have temperature control management there for software for that. We offer some of that. So I believe they're like at an operational level. Luxor is not who will directly participate, but Luxor has a plethora of ways that it can help miners that will operate in the country, be it logistics, sending the ASICs to the country, be it from a firmware perspective, be it from a pool perspective, be it from a financing perspective, because we're the only pool in the market that can offer upfront payments for your future production of hash rate. So some you could potentially foresee some miners that mine with Luxor send hardware to the country, operate it. You know, we collect their historic uptime, and then we say, hey, we can help you sell forward up to 12 months of your hash rate production, and then use that to purchase new equipment that you can send to Venezuela or send to the US. So you could picture a world where you have all these US miners, they have all this old generation of artwork that is unprofitable. They send it to Venezuela, they collect more revenues, and they could use those operations to sell forward the hash rate that they're producing to finance the purchase of more equipment or American mining companies for U.S.-based mining operations. So different ways that you can look at this, but they're all strategic levers of saying, hey, we can continue connecting ties between Venezuela and the U.S.
Amazing stuff. I truly appreciate how your mind works with all this. Really, really good stuff. One of the things that I'm thinking also is the story of Gridless a little bit about how, you know, they're the buyer of, in some cases, the buyer of last resort. They always make sure that people in villages and the places where they're mining or their energy facilities that they're using, that those facilities can provide affordable power to the people there who need it, obviously, before school, before and after work, the times when energy use is high and they do more Bitcoin mining when things are a little bit lower, during the night or during the day when people are at work. Do you see some of this potentially? Because so Venezuelans, before everything collapsed, they were used to having this subsidized power. They were used to having a cheaper power. Venezuelans obviously don't have a lot of money because of everything that's gone on. I mean, that's evidenced by the fact that a third of the country has turned into refugees, essentially. There was no opportunity. Money there obviously is not worth much. The Bolivar is not worth much. Do we see opportunities for Venezuelans on the ground here in terms of Bitcoin miners being something, buyers of last resort, or at least we know someone who's going to buy some of the electricity being generated as the power grid gets renewed, gets rebuilt? Does that help Venezuelans? And then also, are these companies potentially going to be hiring local? What I think about there is some of the work that Sebastian is doing with Big Block Data Center in the Congo. Some of the people that work with Sebastian are some of the best mechanics that know how to fix these machines, because you can't just go and send it back to China or wherever the machine is made. They don't have the time to do that. They don't have the resources to do that. So does this also turn into an industry that, again, supports Venezuelans by subsidizing power on some level, the cost of power on some level, but that also potentially even provides employment to Venezuelans on the ground?
100% of both, because what happens in those use cases you mentioned, like in Africa, is when you talk to the energy producer that they're working with to, you know, basically get them that demand that they were missing. These Bitcoin mining companies are doing is turn profitable some of their projects that were previously unprofitable, because they said, okay, wait, look, this part of Africa is missing electricity. But if we go there and we, as an energy producer, and we finance this energy project, this energy generation plant, there's not enough demand to make it profitable, to run it profitably. So that's where, if we privatize the energy industry in Venezuela, which will be privatized gradually, and we allow private operators to come in and say, hey, look, Venezuela's no longer this single state-owned electricity, like utility company that has to finance all of the power generation projects nationwide, and we allow private companies to come into the country, you know, legally establish themselves and say, hey, now maybe there's not enough demand in this XYZ village, but with the help of XYZ Bitcoin mining company, if we work together, we do a JV, you know, they can help us basically monetize that excess supply, energy supply, that we would have previously been unable to get demand for with only like a rural village in Venezuela. So again, it's like an added benefit in another potential way of working out things for the benefit of Venezuela and the benefit of the electrical grid, the benefit of the energy sector, and it adds up another way.
It almost in a way sounds too good to be true, but we're seeing this reality play out. Like I said, I think in the places where Gridless operates, I always get this wrong, but I believe it's Malawi, Kenya, and Botswana, if I'm not mistaken. And so I think many people who are unfamiliar with this story, this reality of what Bitcoin mining can do, might not see this opportunity. So I think your work seems to be creating this framework for people. So not only within the Venezuelan government to see the opportunity here, which is massive, but obviously then also being the liaison between, well, I don't know if it's liaison, but doing the work to convince companies to come there and set up shop and to then help to orchestrate all of this. who else? This is a big, you know, this is a big endeavor. I think that's a modest way to put it. Who do you see working alongside you with this? How heavy of a lift does this feel like in your mind? Will people quickly or gradually see the opportunity that you see and come on board to sort of naturally support just because the opportunity is there?
Yeah, look, I tweeted out this opportunity like a thread form of the article mentioning Maria Corina Machado, so the, you know, de facto opposition leader. Yep. It went viral in Venezuela, and I got tons of feedback from engineers, oil engineers, Venezuelan oil engineers, a banker that I know pinged me privately, like, hey, whenever this is up, let me know how I can help, how we can, like, finance this. So there's interest. And, you know, I believe, again, this won't be a night-to-day thing, right? It'll probably take years and potentially a new administration in Venezuela. I just say potentially. Maybe it can happen before. But I will do my best, Frank. That's how I can answer that.
You're already doing your best for sure, which is really, really inspiring. But it's good to hear that simply putting the signal out there, putting the word out there is attracting people with some know-how and some not only capability, but maybe financing capabilities to come to your aid, because I think the opportunity is tremendous. And it seems kind of like, you know, just a sit down or two with people at the very least, or simply putting out a tweet thread would be enough to sort of open people's eyes to the level of opportunity here. More broadly, when it comes to a Venezuela revitalized, renewed, a democratic Venezuela, a Venezuela that returns to its glory days of maybe decades ago, I'm not sure. I think I know in the maybe 50s and 60s, Venezuela was truly a destination, but even up until the 80s, you know, it was still a place where it did have its problems. Don't get me wrong. You call it the haves and the have nots. Don't get me, you know, that was there, but nowhere near what it's seen in modern history, nowhere near that. But a place where there's at least opportunity, again, some level of hope, a place where we're not seeing a third of the country have to flee, where people feel safe, where people feel they could build a life and build a family again. What does that timeline look like in your mind?
Yeah, well, look, as I mentioned, we own $180 billion. That is currently 180% of GDP. I believe that to start fixing the economy, the first thing that we have tons of creditors outside, and we defaulted both on our government debt and state oil company debt, okay? We've been defaulting since 2017 when sanctions came in. So we haven't even like paid the interest on that debt since 2017. The National Institute of Statistics in Venezuela has not been publishing the statistics of the economy since then, since like even before. So our creditors globally don't even have an idea of what's the real state of the nation of the Venezuelan economy, right? Like how much are we really making? How much profit is the country getting? And so how much can we service our debt so that we can restructure the debt? I hear from experts and previous directors of Venezuela Central Bank that I've spoken with that the process of just making transparent and calculating the state of the economy and the actual statistics of our economy is a process that will take at a minimum 9 months. So only figuring out where we're currently sitting at will take up to a year, okay? So say a year of transition where we understand what our account balances are, like our real balance sheet, basically. Say another year where we renegotiate the debt, right, with our creditors so that the Venezuelan government bonds are quoted again in the international markets, and they're not like sanctioned equity titles, right? Like or debt titles, I'm sorry. And then we restructure the debt. That will be probably like another year. So the transition of just normalizing things will take 3 to 5 years.
Mm.
Okay, 3 to 5 years at a minimum. Now, what we've seen already, Frank, is the dollar has dropped by 50% in the country already. That is
The dollar versus the Bolivar.
Versus the Bolivar, yeah.
So the Bolivar has been gaining significant strength. I haven't seen this anywhere. Is that right?
That is correct.
Oh, okay.
USDT, at some point during the intervention, went all the way up to 1,000 Bolivars per USDT. It's currently sitting at 500, 520. It dropped all the way down to 385 Bolivars. So at some point, it dropped like more than 60%, right? Wow. So what happened, Alessandro? What happened that what changed? Well, what changed is the state is no longer raking in all the revenues from oil, from the sales of oil to wherever that went before. Mm. And now it's going directly to a trust and a bank in Qatar that the U.S. government set up for Venezuela Central Bank. And so the proceeds of the sales of oil to the U.S. are going to that account. Then again, as I mentioned, the Venezuelan government has to provide a plan for how they want to consume those revenues. Okay. And then it's audited by the U.S. and then released. What is released in this case? It is, those dollars are being poured into the private banking system in Venezuela, and it's a bid and offer process, right? Like supply and demand process for setting up what is the rate in the economy, the exchange rate. So truly more like a free market type of thing, right? It's not a single entity owned by the state that dictates, hey, this is the price of the dollar in the economy. It's more like a participation of all the banking system, basically. Mm-hmm. So what has happened is close to a billion dollars have already landed in the hands of the private banks in Venezuela. And in turn, those dollars are being resold to private companies in Venezuela to import goods from the U.S.
Wow. I did not know this had been... Is this widely reported? I feel like
this is not widely reported. Yeah. And this is intel that I can share with you from a private conversation that I had with one of the presidents of one of the main private banks in Venezuela. I cannot share his name.
Yep.
But you get that. You get it. So that's the whole thing. It's like we sell oil to the U.S. The U.S. gives us dollars in Qatar. Those Qatars go from the Venezuelan Central Bank in Qatar to the Venezuelan Central Bank in Venezuela. It is sold to the private banks, and then the private bank sells it to private companies that import goods from the U.S. So there's already some progress being made. Like up to 20% of all the dollars that were poured into the Venezuelan banking system through the Venezuelan Central Bank in 2024 have already been poured in Venezuela in less than 2 months.
Mm. Wow.
The state can no longer steal the oil revenues. And that's what's happening. We're literally just fixing the accounting here. And that's already making a huge difference, right? Like,
wow.
Yeah.
See, this is the stuff, it's hard. Like, Americans are just so caught up on, like, oftentimes, and I get it for good reason at a certain level. Like, well, it's just another colonial takeover of a Latin American country and blah, blah, blah. I'm like, yeah, but you don't understand. Okay, theoretically, sure, no question. That's what happened. I get it. But on a practical level, things are changing and will continue to change. And most Venezuelans aren't sitting around thinking in like a textbook, thinking, oh, well, these colonists, and it's like, I want to be able to eat in my country again, and I want my country to function again. And this might be like an unfortunate step or not the way some people envisioned it, but it is what it is. And this is sort of what we're dealing with. And dynamics, as you just described, are shifting as a result. So I think looking at it through a little bit less of a philosophical lens and a little bit more of a realistic lens of like, okay, some repair is already now taking place. It's at least also setting up a situation where someone like yourself, who's obviously been incredibly active, both, you know, here in public and behind the scenes, can go back to the country to actually sit down with people and to have incentive-based discussions with them. Here's how, look, because what some of these people who are in power, they're not inherently bad people. They think they just had to sort of, they got swept up in whatever is going on there. It's not that, you know, everybody there who had any sort of affiliation with Maduro, who was in any sort of position of power, was inherently evil or won't do anything ever again there, things are going to shift. Some of those people might be involved. Some of those people might not be involved as things change. But ideally, you want people to feel re-incentivized to do something that they'll still be sort of making money or doing whatever they're doing, but also that Venezuela will benefit as a result, where it's a win-win scenario versus the sort of only the government winning and extracting from people for the last 2 decades or whatever it's been, more than that. Chavez came into power in the late 90s. So sorry about that. A little bit of a, I'm just sort of thinking out loud here as I go through this, because I think it's a really exciting time. But it does seem that people need to be mindful of the fact that it's not a snap of the fingers. Everything changes overnight. And I would imagine it's all just not smooth sailing. There's going to be a lot of negotiations, a lot of things that need to shift. But if we're already seeing a shift in the accounting, if we're already seeing certain deals being made that are benefiting both the U.S. and Venezuelan people, if we're setting up a scenario where it's going to become, or Venezuela can become, a relatively business-friendly state again, and where some of that business activity will provide jobs and subsidized power and things for Venezuelans, then in my mind, it feels like we're on the right track. But let me stop, you know, sort of ranting about it there. You tell me, are you sort of, I mean, it sounds like you're optimistic about things. You know, just, I guess maybe as just as a final thought, is it, does this feel good? You know, I mean, Venezuela has been through hell. You were there while it was going through hell. Does it feel nice to see something change?
You can see it as naive because I still haven't revisited the country after everything that happened, but it feels great, man. Okay. And like, okay. Talk to Venezuelans outside. There's 8 million people outside the country that, as you mentioned, we didn't leave because, you know, things were just like not okay. Now it's like, it was like a big deal. Almost all of them are happy with what's happening at the moment, right? Okay. Like if the bank, and eventually if the banking system down the road gets connected again with the global banking system, right? So like you don't have to juggle as a Venezuelan overseas to send money back to your family, right? You see a stabler dollar with respect to what the market was dictating. So it'll balance. That's basically almost like a de facto dollarization in the country. Yep. So people's wages will be kind of dollarized as well. People's wages will improve. We're finally like, dude, we exported the first molecule of gas for the first time in history this month. Okay.
Well, so first time in modern, well, post all the chaos, I guess.
All the chaos. So like change is happening. There's tons of videos of like hundreds of trucks of just like gas trucks to carry gasoline throughout the country, which was a common thing. It's like, hey, yeah, we are the country with the biggest oil reserves in the world, but all of our refineries are screwed. So we got to refine it overseas and then we got to import it. But we also didn't have like enough trucks to service all the gas pumps in the country. So even the gas pumps, a lot of gas pumps are like inoperative. So things are improving gradually, and I can, maybe I'm not there, but I got family there. I got friends there. I got people from the industry that are there, and everything that I'm receiving is positive comments.
I think we could leave it there. I think that's a good place to leave it. Sultan, this has been a pleasure. As I said, I followed your work forever. I really admire, it seems like, what you're not only doing currently, but what you have been doing for a while, it seems like, because it doesn't, I would imagine some of these people you're speaking with, those aren't relationships that just get spun up overnight. So obviously you've cared deeply about your country and fixing it in this time since you've been away. Ideally, if you do get back this year, if you actually want to ping me and let me know if it's safe to come and visit, I'm very much looking forward to getting back and seeing it with my own two eyes as well. But I wish you and obviously the Venezuelan people all the best. I do hope that Bitcoin mining does have this positive catalytic effect on the people there, on the country as a whole. And I think these are ideally exciting times. We're making the best of a very tough situation, and it seems like we're sort of pushing in the right direction. So thank you for the work you're doing to help that be the case. And it's been a pleasure speaking with you, my friend.
Look, Fran, it's great connecting with you after so long. And it's, one doesn't get to rebuild a country every day of our life.
Yeah, right. So
Man, maybe the time is now more than ever. And also, whenever the time comes to visit the country, I'll let you know. And the first cold one goes on me, man.
I appreciate that. I appreciate that. Well, again, it's been a pleasure. Yeah, we'll talk soon.
All right, sir. Have a good one.
All right. Take it easy, everybody. Talk soon. Pretty awesome stuff, no? Alessandro is absolutely incredible. I'm truly excited to see what he accomplishes in the upcoming year or so, especially when he returns to Venezuela to start doing some work on the ground. Venezuela is super lucky to have someone like him, someone who truly gets Bitcoin and Bitcoin mining, and who also truly wants the best for his country. Really, really exciting stuff. Thank you to everyone who tuned into this episode. As mentioned, if you could hit the like and subscribe button, maybe leave a comment or a review, I would greatly appreciate that. It helps the algorithm to find us, and we're trying to make sure these stories get spread far and wide. So please, if you could help us out, we would greatly appreciate that. And again, please email me at newrencap@gmail.com. That's NEWRENCAP at gmail.com. I'm always looking for leads for really cool stories or interviewees, people who are doing really important work to help facilitate Bitcoin adoption around the globe. We're looking for those underreported stories. We want to help amplify the work that people are doing to bring Bitcoin, especially to the furthest corners of the globe. So please keep me in the loop. Again, thank you to everybody for watching. We will be back next week. Take it easy, everybody.